You've tuned in to the Round Table Podcast, episode 22.
Hello, everybody. I'm Brian Humphrey.
And I'm Dave Robison.
And you're listening to the Round Table Podcast.
On the Round Table Podcast, Brian and I invite writers to come onto the show and present a story idea to us and our esteemed guest host.
And then we dig into it, we play with it, we mold it, and the writer throws out everything that we say, but then walks away with something really amazing, which we like to call...
literary gold.
Most definitely, yes.
How you doing, Brian? I know you're not used to recording this early in our day.
I woke up like an hour ago and
still hacking
turned on
up
the
phlegm.
Water outside. Yeah, had a breakfast shake, and I'm kind of zombified, but I'm doing okay.
You know,
I'm coming around.
And perhaps being in that altered state, that twilight between full consciousness and the deep dark place that you go when you sleep, will inform your ideas. So for this episode, we may get to see a glimpse of that deep dark subconscious place where Brian lives.
That's right. That's right.
And speaking of deep, dark, subconscious places,
yes,
is that a good segue? I think we can
absolutely
work with that.
Sure.
Yeah, let's invite our guest host to join in on the festivities, folks. Hopefully, you have sampled the gloriosity that is Seanan McGuire in some way, shape, or form. There are so many ways to do it, whether it's accessing one of her four CDs, sampling some of the delight of the fiction or nonfiction that's out there, the Cryptid series, the October Day series, so much gloriosity to be savored. And now we have her here for the show. So once again, Seanan, thank you so much for making time and helping us make the roundtable that much more awesome.
No problem, although you're making me sound like a TV infomercial.
Oh.
Now, how much would you pay?
And
also,
if you
Brian,
act now.
Yeah,
yes.
Brian, I'll see you got up an hour ago and raise you woke up 2 minutes after the start of this podcast.
There you go.
I definitely
haven't been bitten by anything poisonous to match up with you, so I think that's two drinks that I owe you now.
So everybody is sitting with 1 foot deep in their subconscious. This is going to be awesome. So Seanan, vast epic canon of work behind you, and an eternity of work ahead of you, judging by your 20 minutes with interview. So what's next? What's coming up? What's on Seanan McGuire's day planner that our listeners need to know about?
You think you're making a funny joke, but I actually carry a day planner. It is my external brain. Well, what's up next in terms of things to be read is the 6th October Day book is coming out in September, and that's called Ashes of Honor. And I am over the freaking moon because this is the series that everybody got so tired of.
Really?
All of my friends hit the point where they were like, sure, Seanan, you're going to write a multi-volume urban fantasy series about a pissed-off detective who just wants a fucking cup of coffee. And I'm like, book 6, bitches!
Eat it!
I love Toby. She's been my imaginary friend for so long. And book 6 kind of starts us into the second half of the first arc. So it's amazing that it's there. It's like when we sold Rosemary and Rue, I had the first 3 books done. The 4th book was in revisions and the 5th book was partially done. So this is the first one that's completely new. I'm like, really happy.
Wow.
In October, I have a Mira Grant book coming out called When Will You Rise, which is the first print edition of my Hugo-nominated novella, Countdown. And also includes a short story called Apocalypse Scenario Number 683, The Box, which got me fan mail from the Department of Defense.
Oh, my God. Really?
Wow.
Yeah, really. Because that's not upsetting. We're all going to die. We're all going to die.
Now, what did you reveal national secrets in this story? What the hell?
Well, I explained how if I were to decide to unleash a sleepwalker pandemic, I would get it into the population without being caught. And got a very nice, like, ah, gosh, that was a bang whiz story note from the Department of Defense.
Like, oh. We're watching you.
Well, my brother and I are already pretty damn sure that that my phone calls are the Homeland Security equivalent of Comedy Central. Hey, the Bond girl's talking about slate wipers again. Get on the line.
there's some Department of Defense blog that no one can get to, and your phone conversations are posted.
Yeah, that would not be honestly too far outside the realm of possibility. They're probably all reading the X-Men now, though, so that they can understand me. So, hey, you're welcome, Marvel.
I'll take a cut of that. Yeah.
I'll take a cut of that. And that's actually it for book-length fiction in 2012. The second encrypted novel comes out in March of 2013, which is called Midnight Blue Light Special. I have a novella as Mira Grant coming out on July 11th called San Diego 2014, The Final Stand of the California Browncoats.
All right.
Wow.
Which I swear I wrote just to make Orbit's legal department twitch. it's fun, and it's about when the Rising from my Newsflesh series came to the San Diego Comic Con, and a lot of people die. Everyone died. It's so deathy. Like, there's just death everywhere. Fortunately for me, I will be at San Diego Comic Con this year.
Cool.
I've been every year since I was 14, so it's always a fortunately for me. Other girls go to spa weeks. I go to San Diego.
Are you going to stage a coup this year? Is that the what I'm hearing?
No, I've got panels as me. I've got panels as Mira. Mostly, I go for the zen. I literally go to San Diego so that I can step into a giant room full of crap that wants my money, and just sort of flow with the crowd. It's like being a blood. It's like being a blood cell in a body. You kind of.
I don't think I've ever heard it described quite that way. That's brilliant.
I do the large photo knots that occasionally form in walkways. P.S. If you're listening to this and you're one of those people, don't do that! Is it the body? But other than that, I have a grand old time. I've done San Diego every year since I was 14. I love it. I'm also going to be guest of honor at Confluence out in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, July 27th to 29th. And will be guest of honor at WindyCon in Chicago, in Lombard, Illinois, from November 8th to 11th, along with Amy McNally, who is their music guest. She is my lovely fiddler girl. She's on all four of my CDs. And if you're in the Illinois area, if you're in the Chicago area, if you're in Indiana, well, if you're in Indiana, you're probably related to me. But apart from that, you should really come out to WindyCon. We're going to have a fantastic time. And you can see what happens when Amy gets me really hopped up on sugar, which is, I'm told, kind of terrifying.
Sweet. Definitely. And we will include all of that gloriosity in the liner notes for this episode. I noticed that Worldcon's not in that list.
Oh, cripe! Worldcon!
There we go.
It's not actually on my appearances. I'm reading off my own website because I'm not remembering where I'm... I can't find my planner!
Your brain is gone.
My brain is missing. It was on the bed last night when I went to go to bed, and so I kind of tossed it on the floor, and... God only knows. Oh, there it is. It's out of reach if I have the headset on.
No worries.
Yeah, I left off WorldCon and also a trip to Disneyland.
Oh, God. That's going to be a surreal experience.
Oh, I love Disneyland. I love it so much. Actually, so I'm doing WorldCon. I am nominated for 4 Hugo Awards this year, which is the first time any woman has ever been on the ballot 4 times in a single year.
Go Shannon. Holy crap. That's awesome.
Yeah, twice as me and twice as Mira, and since I am Mira, that counts for me.
Absolutely.
And that means that I'm not going to remember much about Worldcon after the fact, and unfortunately that I keep kind of trying to block it out of my mind, because while I'm sure I will have a lovely, lovely time, the terror aspect is rather high this year. I am, however, going to be bartending for bartending. And when I say bartending, I mean that I'm going to be showing up in frilly lingerie, my science's blue Starfleet robe, and show authentic trill spots that go all the way down. I mix a mean cocktail. I am a licensed bartender in 2 states. You should really, really drop by if you're going to be at Worldcon.
Oh, my God.
They are, I believe, the only party that will have a Hugo nominee mixing their drinks for them.
Oh, the epic, the awesomeness, my mind is blown.
And I'm going to Disneyland. You know, further in the future, which normally I wouldn't bring up, but Disneyland, in 2014, Worldcon will hopefully be in London.
Yes.
And it is followed a week later by Eurocon 2014 in Dublin, Ireland.
Wow.
And you're doing that.
Shamrock Con, and I'm a guest of honor in Ireland. Oh. And because I will have a week between Worldcon in London and Eurocon in Ireland, I'm going to Euro Disney.
Yes.
Totally.
Holy crap.
So me, Catherine Valenti, and a couple of other folks are going to go invade Disney Paris for a week.
Oh, hire a film crew and follow you guys around. Holy crap.
I will be that film crew.
Yeah. Given that Kat and I are both renegade Disney princesses, this is going to be epic.
Man, seriously, that's the documentary of the year. That's totally got to be there.
And lots and lots of books. You should watch my bibliography. Things change so fast around here. You know, we're trying to get a print edition of Sparrow Hill Road, which is that 12 interlocked stories, and I've rewritten them, and I think they're a lot tighter and stronger now, which makes me happy. There's a new Mira Grant series starting up. It's going to be fun.
Wow. And cool. Yes, I should have been taking notes. Holy crap. That's a veritable buffet of fabulosity. So
it's a good thing that we have this recorded.
Yeah, no kidding. I'll be getting all of this awesomeness in the liner notes, and definitely follow at Seanan's, website for updates and new news on that.
And everything is on my website
at SeananMaguire.com.
That's right.
Ding. Awesome. All right. Well, that being said and done, I'm going to propose, I need a break just to catch my breath from that. Yes. So what do you say we take a short pause to showcase another fabulous podcast or awesome audiobook? And when we come back after catching our breath, we can then workshop a story and continue the fabulosity. Does this appeal to anyone?
Yay. Brilliant, yes.
Awesome. All right, friends, stay tuned. We'll be right back.
In 1953, a remote research station in the Antarctic encounters something.
God in heaven. If that thing's a meteor, it'll crack the continent.
That ain't no meteor. It's changing direction.
Nobody knows what it is.
Mac and Childs don't think it was a meteor.
That's crap. You know it.
Who says life hasn't evolved out there?
We found a body.
No, my sweet Jesus.
Are those worms?
This is a joke, right?
Look out. He's changing.
Ah! His head. Are those legs?
He means that maybe we all should die.
Coming June 25th, 2012, from Must Be Nice Studios. Go to mustbenicestudios.podomatic.com.
Welcome back, everybody. I think we've significantly warmed up the mics and spent some quality time with our fabulous guest host. Dave, what do you say we jump into the workshop proper and introduce our guest writer?
Absolutely. The meat and potatoes of the Roundtable Podcast is workshopping a story idea. We can't do that without an awesome guest writer. And Brian, our guest writer fights with lasers during the day.
That's so cool.
I know. Beyond awesome. on top of that, she recently got her master's in theological studies from the Asbury Theological Seminary. And on top of all of this awesomeness, in the evening, she runs a personal blog at Goals Drumbeat. That's GOLSDrumbeat.com, where she posts her fictional efforts and also her ruminations, explorations, and insights into the writing process. So, dear friends and listeners, guest host and Brian, welcome to the Skype line, Gloria Seguntas. Gloria, thank you so much for stepping up and offering a story for the Roundtable Podcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, do you really fight with lasers during the day? That's just beyond awesome.
Yeah, I like to say it that way because it sounds way cooler than what it actually is. I work for a company that makes promotional type of stuff. And I work in the department that makes the little silicone bracelets with stuff burned into them.
Ah.
And we use a laser printer to do that.
So during breaks, do you turn the laser printers on each other and have fights?
You know what? If I could, I actually spend most of my time wishing that Superman would show up, take the printer, and hurl it into the sun.
I see a career change in your future. How did you get into writing?
I have, you know, my mother has a picture of me from when I was like 5. And I'm sitting on the front porch next to my little Teddy Ruxpin, which I don't know how many of the listeners will actually remember what a Teddy Ruxpin is.
I remember.
I love that little guy.
I have mine.
You know
one.
What? My brother destroyed mine.
Oh.
He's in pieces somewhere. Yeah. My brother, not at the moment, but yeah. He was cool, but this picture is me sitting next to him, and instead of him doing his nice little telling me stories, I was telling him stories. So I've pretty much been telling and writing and making up stories as long as I can remember.
That's fabulous.
I got serious about really thinking I would become a writer when I was in high school.
Okay. Well, let's explore that then. Let's dig into it. You brought a story to the table.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to turn the mic over to you. You've got 5 to 8 minutes. Give us the title, the genre, the format, a hook line if you've got one. Introduce us to some of the key characters, and then give us the key plot points of the story that you have so far, and then we'll start the workshop. So
Okay. The
mic is all yours, Gloria.
Okay. Do let me know if I start talking too fast, because I think I talk fast. But anyway.
We'll keep an eye out for that.
Okay. So the working title right now is called The Rescue, and the genre of this story is a fantasy set in a space-like setting. It will be a novel, and it's going to be written in cinematic third person. So this story, I kind of think of it as Leverage meets Disney's Treasure Planet. And the hook is, when an innocent girl is going to be executed for being at the wrong place at the wrong time, her only hope is in the hands of her brother and a group of misfits who are more likely to kill each other than work together. I just want to take a moment to stop and describe the world that it's in. The world is actually based on a medieval cosmology where the sun, the moon, and the 5 planets revolve around the Earth. In this story, the Earth isn't there. It's just kind of there's a hub or a nexus. Sometimes it's called the Grave of Stars. I haven't really figured out what the names of the worlds are, so I'm just going to kind of give what I'm working with them as, which is Luna, Mercury, Venus, Solus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. I have 2 protagonists, Niam and Noel. They're brothers and sisters. A little bit of their backstory. They are from Solus. All the people there are magical. There's pure magic, which is the magic of light, and unclean magic, which is the magic of elementals. Noel and Niam are elemental magic, so they are in the lower class. Niam can control fire, and Noel can control ice. Niam has gotten involved with a group of, well, sometimes they're called freedom fighters, and sometimes they're called terrorists. Noel knew nothing about this and got caught in the crosshairs during a raid. During most of the story, we're going to travel with Niam as he tries to rescue her, but we will from time to time see what's going on with Noel. As the story is both about Niam trying to rescue his sister and Noel finding her own strength. My helper is a character named Thea. Thea is the daughter of the greatest thief who has ever lived and is a pilot of a starship, the Shiul, her occupation is called Kazi. The Shiul is a intelligent ship, and Thea is the one who has the ability to cajole and manipulate this little group of misfits into working together. She knows Noel and Niam from a past job where she helped them steal a relic from the ruler of Jupiter, which is where Thea is from. On to the misfits. The first is Elliot, who is a blind thief. Think of him kind of like Daredevil. There is Leo, who is basically a grifter, and Kai, who is a mercenary for hire, and the only escaped prisoner from the prison planet Mars, where all the inmates are basically gladiators. These three all have reason to hate each other. Elliot hates Leo because Leo sold information about his family that led to Elliot losing his physical eyes and now has no idea where his family is. Leo hates Kai because she kidnapped somebody under Leo's protection. That somebody was then sold as a slave, and Leo can't find her. Kai doesn't trust Elliot because he knows that she is a Koli, an elite and magically enhanced soldier, which were all sent to Mars once the threat had passed. So here's some things about the story. I'm just going to go ahead and go into major, just a bit of a summary of each of the three acts, because I think in a three-act structure. Act one opens with Noelle in an interrogation room, scared out of her mind. We then go to watch Niamh try to figure out how to rescue her when his commanders have a strict policy that those who fall behind stay behind. He gets help from a mysterious character known only as the Voice, then goes to find Thea, who helps him assemble the team that the Voice has suggested he collect. The act ends with the Sheol being hailed by a Elmatant ship. I'm going to pause for a second to describe what they are. The Elmatant are basically the system's police force. They have been practicing selective breeding for generations, and they have a strict policy against magical manipulation of any person beyond a particular point. And they were the main force behind the Koli being sent to a prison world. Their name means "we will be perfect" in Latin. So, moving back to the summary of the novel. Mm-hmm. Act 2 opens with a scene of Noelle being tortured. Then we join the group who are taken prison by the Elimat. That's how it's pronounced, Elimat. The midpoint is them breaking out and comes to an abrupt end, the midpoint that is, when Thea gets shot just as they reach the Sheol. We then cut to a scene of Noelle in her cell, then back to the Sheol where everything's going crazy. Kai and Leo try to stabilize Thea while Niamh gets a crash course in flying a starship. This act ends when Niamh crash lands on a Luna. Act 3 is where things get murky. Like the other acts, it's going to open with a Noelle scene, and then Niamh will step up to the plate and come up with a plan. At the climax, Noelle will be rescued, and this act will end at a little diner where Noelle and Niamh are reunited with their mother and safe from danger, with this little bit of conversation where Kai leans over to Thea and says, "You know, we make a pretty good team." Thea answers, "Your point?" "No point," says Kai. "Just saying." And, I actually read through that a lot faster than I thought I would.
You did a fine job. You're well under time.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Gloria, let me ask you before we get into this, what are you hoping to get out of this conversation? What would you like us to focus on? What are you really hoping you can walk away with?
Okay, one thing that I really started to realize as I was, I do a very detailed outline where I actually break it down into scenes and then I outline what's going to happen in each scene. And as I got to the end of Act 2, I realized that my protagonist had been pushed to the sidelines and had become really passive. So that's why I ended up deciding to shoot Thea, because she was kind of taking all the glory and all the limelight.
Good.
And then I started to try and work out what was all, how everything was going to come down in Act 3. And I have no idea where I'm going plot-wise anymore. I'm not sure what I need to happen. I'm not sure how to make things work.
Okay. We can explore this and see what creative threads get knocked loose as we discuss. But before we do, Brian, please make sure that we're all safe and legal with our disclaimer.
Most definitely. So through the course of our workshopping, Dave and I and Seanan are going to throw out a lot of really excellent ideas, maybe some not so excellent ideas, and you have absolutely every right to disregard anything that you have no interest in using, because everything that we say can and very likely is complete and total bullshit.
Bam.
Yay!
Absolutely. So with that said and that clear, we're all free to just spout and ramble and froth as we are wont to do. And we will always defer to our guest host for opening comments, observations, questions for clarity, and general such whatnot. So, Seanan, lead us off. What did you think of Gloria's idea? What questions do you have, observations? Lead us into this.
So I was noticing the same thing that you mentioned, that your protagonist's got very much sidelined.
Mm-hmm.
It felt less like a book with two protagonists as you were describing it, and more like an ensemble piece with no real protagonist. What age range are you envisioning this as? Are you envisioning this as an adult novel, or you are envisioning it as a YA?
I'm envisioning it as an adult novel. The characters are all in their, would be in about the early 20-ish type of range, or at least that mentality.
Okay. You may have an easier time with that type of plot right now in the YA genre, but we write where we write, and I get so much crap for doing urban fantasy. I'm never going to tell someone to move to a genre they don't want to be in. Mm-hmm. That's still something you might want to consider, because the plot as described feels very much younger people finding themselves, finding a place in this cosmology. And so you may well, when you finish it and start pitching it, be pushed toward YA with a finished product, which would be harder than considering it now.
Right.
I also, is there a reason that you're going with cinematic third? Is that just how you're comfortable, or?
It's, I've done first person, not first person, but third person closed where I follow one point of view, and I have a tendency to get bored. Mm-hmm. So I jump to, well, you know, I want to get to this over here, but I want to jump over, but to get there from this character, I have to go through all these loops, and I'd just rather jump and just talk about it from this person's point of view.
You may have an ease, and this is, you know, take and try rewriting a chapter just as an experiment. You may find that it is easier to keep your protagonists from getting sidelined if you do alternating first. And even with alternating first, you can have chapters that are third to switch to a different character. That's actually, I've seen that a lot recently. Not so much that I'm suggesting a cliche, but enough that people will accept it.
Okay.
And that way, you know, you do a chapter from your brother, you do a chapter from your sister, and then, wha-bam, here's a third-person interlude with Thea overdoing what she's doing that they couldn't see. And now the reader feels like they're actually getting knowledge that your characters don't have, like they're in a privileged position.
That's excellent. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's actually, I'm trying to think of who it is, but he wrote Patient Zero, and it's his main character is Joe Ledger.
That's Jonathan Mabry.
Yes, yes. And he does that where the first person is his protagonist, and then anytime that he switches to third person, it follows his antagonists. And it's a really cool flip back and forth. But he introduces right at the top of the chapter who it is and what time, and so that you know before you even start reading that there's going to be a shift in point of view.
Exactly.
But it's very effective.
Yeah, it works really well, and I think it would help to resolve some of that your protagonist getting sidelined thing, because even if your protagonist is the most boring person in the book, if you're filtering everything through their impression of it, they can't be left out.
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent point. That's good stuff.
Yeah, and it gives you a little bit of flexibility too, in terms of, you know, like if you're writing strictly from two different characters, you know, or from third person with two different characters, there's always a lot of what else is going on that we need to know about. But if those characters aren't involved in those scenes, you feel constricted, like you can't go talk about it, and so it opens you up a little bit.
Yeah. Shauna, any other initial impressions or questions?
I like your world. I think that's a very, that's not something I have seen. And I read a disgusting amount. I go through about 7 books a week.
Wow.
I still have a day job with a 2-hour-a-day commute. It's amazing how much reading you can get done.
Wow.
In that. So that's not a cosmology I have seen before. That also, at the same time, means that you're not going to have a pre-established shorthand with your audience.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to need to watch for a trap that I fall into a lot, which is the excessively detailed world building. I can tell you're in love with your setting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm half in love with your setting just from listening to you talk about it because it's interesting. Mm-hmm. But it's going to make, let me tell you about the political climate on Seoul for 30 pages, really tempting.
Right.
Honestly, and keep in mind that I said, you know, I've said many, many times that I am addicted to series.
Mm-hmm.
But honestly, I think you're right about your 3-act structure, that you've got act 1, 2, and 3. And they will they will get more complex and more detailed as you write them. I don't think there's anything wrong with not knowing at the outset exactly what happens in Act 3. Because if you go in saying Act 3 ends with this, you've taken a lot of creative freedom away from yourself, and you've taken mm-hmm. a lot of reactionary freedom away from your characters. But I think that you may also want to give serious thought to the question of, are you looking at Acts 1, 2, and 3, or are you looking at Books 1, 2, and 3? Because you've got so much setting, and you've got so many characters that you're clearly very attached to, that you're not going to take, yeah, cut Thea, yeah, cut one of your protagonists. That's not a comment that I want to give or that you want to hear. But it may be easier for you to sell that much setting and that many people if you do it over the course of three books.
Yeah. Yeah. That opens up all kinds of possibilities.
Yeah.
That's actually interesting, because this is like what I'm planning to do is take, and each of the other characters will get their chance to have their issues resolved in their own thing. So that could open this up and change a lot of things, which would be fun. But
sure, and even each book in the series could, you know, continue the storyline, the arc, but be a focus on Elliot or Leo or Kai or Thea, and you know, continue having Niamh and Noel be the spine of the story theme, the story arc.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. That's great.
Yeah.
Brian, first impressions, points of clarification?
Sure. When I'm looking back at my notes, what I've got, and I'm you know, I'm sure I missed about 20% because I'm writing furiously, and I go, oh crap, what was the name of that character that she just mentioned? But so I'm sure that I'll get some of these wrong. But is the whole thing essentially a rescue attempt?
That's the overarching of this particular story. Yes.
Okay.
It's a rescue attempt.
Okay. And then when you said, you know, that you feel like your protagonist is fairly passive, I think a lot of that comes from that it seems like she's sitting around a lot waiting for rescue.
Yeah.
And I didn't hear, and this might be part of the 20% that I missed, but I didn't hear who your primary antagonist is.
Yeah, that's where things get a little funky for this. Okay. As I was breaking it down, because I wanted to break this down in I don't know, what is it called? I think it's called the Hollywood method, where you figure out who the actual, like, the protagonist is the person who wants something, the helper is the one who helps them get there, and then the antagonist is the one who stands in their way. Right. It's not necessarily the big bad evil guy. There can be a big bad evil guy in the story, but mm-hmm. that's not necessarily the antagonist. And so when I was putting it together, it looked more like the antagonist was the fact that these three people are so at odds with each other that what has to happen in order for Niamh to get what he wants is to cause people to work together. There are a couple of minor big overlord type of groups that of people who show up, like for Noel it's the interrogator, or mm-hmm. I think his name is just the director, I don't have that note in front of me, who's basically trying to get her to tell him something, anything about this group, but she doesn't know anything.
Right.
So
okay, so where my brain is going with this is, I'm, you know, I feel like there needs to be somebody, and maybe it's the interrogator, but somebody in the prison. So another question that I have, but I want to go through this real quick, is why is she in there in the first place? And what is she being interrogated for? What is it that these people want from her? And then the interrogator, if that's somebody that is in the prison that consistently creates conflict with her, then she may come across as a lot stronger if she has scenes where she's not necessarily waiting for somebody to rescue her. She's trying to find a way to get out on her own. Mm-hmm. And each attempt that she makes, she's learning more about how strong she really is.
Right.
So that when the actual rescue attempt comes around, if she was not at the point that she is because of everything that she's learned, it would not have gone off correctly. And then the other thing that you can do, because you were talking about not necessarily having, you know, this bad, evil overlord, you know, antagonist, is maybe the interrogator is sort of has a duality who, you know, causes her challenge, causes her all this conflict, but by the end, something about him allows her not, I don't want to say allows her, because we want her to be able to escape of her own volition, but mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
you could do something with that where he's got some kind of duality that would actually make him a little more human too.
Mm. Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think you really, you do need to nail down, why is she there? And you may already have that.
Yeah.
That
I come actually across have
pretty
that.
Strong. But, okay, good.
It's really, the terrorist organization was raided and she happened to be there and she's the one that got caught. So they assume she's okay. part of this, but she's not.
Okay, so part of it too may be that they're holding her there almost as a trap because they know that the others are going to come and try and rescue her.
Yeah, there you go. A lure to bring in the rest of the freedom fighters.
Right.
For myself, Gloria, first of all, Treasure Planet, my favorite movie ever. played
oh,
several times on the Robison DVD player through the course of the year.
I love you now, Dave.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, when you said that before, I was like, oh, that's awesome, because it's so underappreciated.
I know, right?
It was so awesome.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Emma Thompson as a fox captain. Oh, my God.
He's a cat.
Cat, yes.
Yeah, he's definitely a cat.
Good point. Yes, cat, because he's a dog, and they end up together. And oh, that's awesome.
It's one of those where you look at what they did with the source material, and it's just phenomenal.
Yes.
Gorgeous.
And yet they still track the original Treasure Island almost word for word to some extent. So, yes, awesomeness. Yeah. So I really think...
Anyway, go.
Let's move on. Yes. Yeah. we'll have a side podcast.
I'm really
going the virtues of awesomeness.
I haven't seen it.
The Treasure Planet.
Go watch the movie, yes. Brian.
Okay, all right.
Dude, seriously?
I've already written it down and boxed it several times.
Okay, have you seen Chronicle yet?
No.
Oh, my God.
Have you seen Disney's Hercules?
No.
Wait.
Disney's Hercules?
Yes.
Is that what you said?
With Megara?
Yes.
The animated one, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. 2 out of 3 is 66%. As a teacher, you know what your grade is.
You mean 33%?
Well,
because
63%. Yeah. Right. Exactly. That's why you're the teacher, and I'm this guy.
Not.
Yes. Not.
Well, that's
exactly.
why I don't teach film. So.
Okay. But be that as it may be,
I have read Treasure Island. So there you go.
Oh, man. That's the first book I read when I got my Kindle. So there. But let's see. What was I talking about? Oh, yes.
I have no idea.
Gloria's story.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's why we're here, isn't
That's
it?
That's why we're here. First of all, so that right there, awesomeness. I love the idea of the misfit band that hates each other being the only hope for Niamh as he goes to rescue his sister. I think that's got a lot of mileage just for great dialogue, wonderful side stories, and is not done nearly enough. I hope you don't pull any punches with that and really make them hate each other and somehow manage to come together as a team. It kind of, if you think about it, it's kind of almost Star Wars-ish in a way, with Luke being falling in with Han Solo and Chewbacca and this disreputable group, the Rebels, so blah, blah, blah. But I don't want to riff on that too much. Some questions, actually one specific question that totally glared out at me. Who or what is the voice that helps Nian in Act 1?
Yeah.
The voice is a complete rip from James Cameron TV show Dark Angel.
Okay.
He is completely based off of Eyes Only, which an underground news reporter that's a general, just all around good guy. He's trying to put the world back together and make sure that people who are good and who are being taken advantage of are, you know, get their justice or, you know, they're
what's his taken stake care in this? Of.
At stake in this story?
Yeah. Why is the voice helping Niamh?
The voice is helping Niamh simply because it kind of it appeals to his sensibilities. He has actually worked with Noelle and Niamh before. It was also I mentioned that he and Noelle did something with Thea, and that's connected back to the voice.
Right.
Okay. In the backstory, but okay. He doesn't like to see innocent people suffer, and so he's able to, you know, put very little resources behind this. So it's not like
he's an info guide. He's a guider. He can move them in. Okay, cool.
Yeah, he likes to.
Okay, some of the things that really just popped in my brain as you mentioned them, the Grave of Stars, the nexus around which everything revolves, that captures my imagination hugely. The fact that Noelle is ice and Niamh is fire is very cool. I like the contrasts that you're setting up in these characters and the story that you're evolving. The fact that these guys, that there are freedom fighters, who are they fighting against?
This group that Niamh works for, they're called freedom fighters and they're also called terrorists, and it's really hard to decide what they are. And it
Do you know?
Yes, I know.
Okay, what are they?
They're mostly terrorists. They have a good cause, but their actions are not good.
And what is that
basically
cause?
The cause is basically a civil rights movement that's going on their actual planet. Okay. In their actual world. It's very close. It's just something that's closed off. They're trying to have basically a violent civil rights movement.
Okay. And just a little bit of world clarification, one more bit. Why then, if the civil rights and these freedom fighters are focused on this one planet, why is Noelle taken to another planet for interrogation? Does this other planet?
Oh, she's not.
She's not.
The prison that she is in is one that's is on that planet.
Okay.
So it's everything there. Everything with their group and their planet is completely. They have a bit of an isolationist mentality where they don't want people from other worlds dealing with them, and they don't deal with other worlds as much.
So the scope of this story is going to be bound very much just around this one world within your grand cosmology.
Yes.
Okay. Cool.
For the most part. Yeah.
That helps. One last thing, and then I will toss it off to Shauna, and we can start more round tabling. The fact that Thea and Noelle and Niamh stole a relic together, and the fact that the voice was involved in that in some way is screaming to me that there is a much larger story being told. That the voice has an agenda. That Thea and Niamh and Noelle that Noelle it's not happenstance. And this is kind of a what if, but the fact that Noelle accidentally got kidnapped, I'm kind of thinking it feels like no, it looks that way, but that's not really what happened. There's a very specific agenda being played out by Noelle being captured, maybe having something to do with the stolen relic, maybe having something to do with the voice, the fact that these other people know that these people are the favorite of their voice. They're trying to draw the voice out. I'm looking for more of a stronger underpinning of your story arc in addition to this very nice basic, you know, rescue operation that might give some more motivation, some more legs to the characters, and some more impetus and specificity to their motivations. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense, and I can't believe I hadn't thought of that.
Awesome. That being said, Shannon, off to you. What else you got, lady?
So I'm kind of trying to think about this as my agent would complain at me about something that I was pitching.
Excellent.
That's her job, is to explain to me why I'm brilliant and wonderful and she loves me desperately and everything I do is wrong. And that's why she is, in fact, the perfect agent. One thing I have to ask is not about the world, because I'm all about the world. I would read a 300-page dissertation on the world with no plot at all, and I was one of those people who thought the Silmarillion had a point.
Oh, my God.
I love the Silmarillion so much. Sorry.
Here's the thing. Why do I care? You know, dumb girl goes and gets herself in the wrong place. Okay. Freedom fighters, what are they freedom fighting for? You have given me no social oppression. You have given me no situation where I'm like, oh man, your life is hard. You've just said, here's the world and P.S. there's freedom fighters. I need to see some injustice before I care that they're fighting for their freedom. The other question that Diana would ask me, and so I am going to ask you, not necessarily because I think it is correct, but because I'm presuming you're writing this with the eye toward publication at some point in the future, that you would really like to get this out there, because that's usually why we take the time to actually write it. Mm-hmm. And that is, where is my romance? You know, where is my, seriously, why are they brother and sister? It would be so much hotter if your fire boy and your ice girl were having an illicit romance and, oh my God, they could have steam babies. You know? And again, I am not saying that you should make that change, but that is something that you should think about so that when you are asked, when you go to the pitch point and you take this to an agent and say, I'd like to sell it, and they go, why is there no romance here? You know, at the end of the day, Dave and Brian, step off to the side. At the end of the day, you and I have female names on our books.
Yes.
And there is always going to be the question, where is the romance if we don't put it in there? And it does help. That is honestly what brings people back for the next volume.
What do you think, Gloria?
Well, there is romance. One of the, first off, the reason why I wanted Noelle and Niamh to be brother and sister is because I really like the story of familial
bloods
or bonds, just like how much the brother-sister relationship is important. Mm-hmm. That's to say that there is not romance in this book. In Elliot and Thea are actually lovers.
Excellent.
And one of the reasons why I want the, I have right now been sticking with the cinematic viewpoint is because I threw a sex scene between Thea and Elliot in, and it's all from Elliot's point of view, as in what he sees, because he's physically blind, but the way in which he sees, he describes people a lot of times as having colors or as their lives being tapestries that he can kind of view. So it was just kind of a fun little thing that I tried, and I really like, so I keep that in there. Also, there is a relationship before Kai with a young man who they've been kind of hiding their own identities from each other because he's actually part of this, part of the Elmiant, the purebloods, or not purebloods, but the people who really kind of are the police force of the system. And by that, they are... They've been hiding that from each other because he doesn't want anybody to know that's what he is because he's trying to get away from that and she can't let anybody know what she is. Hmm. And then at the midpoint, they're actually on the ship, his father's ship, and so they kind of both get, by the way, you've been sleeping with the enemy. So that's where my romance is.
It's kind of peripheral, though, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
It
doesn't have to be central, but, okay, the thing I am starting to pick up more than ever, I'm going to say, that this cannot be a single book.
Yeah.
Everything that you're saying you want to cram in there, I couldn't have fit into Feed, and that's 500 pages long. You could use that book to kill a man. This is either a story in need of some serious streamlining, or it is not a single standalone book.
Yeah.
You don't you know, as Dave was saying, you don't really have a strong antagonist in the literary sense. The Hollywood sense, your antagonist is what does your character want, but Hollywood will also sustain long, slow Robert Patterson movies. And will sustain things like Elizabethtown, where the antagonist is the fact that your hero is really, really bored. You need more of a face on your bad.
Okay.
You need more of a thing that people can see to fight against. I also, and I can be wrong, you know, of course, this is all 90% of what anyone says to you about your work is bullshit.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But the more you talk about this, the more it feels like a YA story to me. This is the kind of thing that's happening in YA right now. It's not what's going on in the adult stuff. You've got such a radically different than the standard cosmology. And I think that your Treasure Planet aspects really come through strongly, which is a fantastic thing. But it means I really do believe that your audience, both as readers and as publishers that would look at this, are in YA.
Yeah.
I can see it. I can see it.
I know. It's frustrating.
Oh, I have a lot of friends who are trying to become YA authors. And I look at what they're reading, and I remember when I first showed a part of this, which was actually Thea's story, like which started with her being very young, and I wanted to, of course, it was her origin story, so I wanted to get to when she was older, because it was more interesting. And they basically said it was YA, and I've listened to, like, the compliments on what is YA, and I just look at it and be like, but I don't like YA as a genre label, because it's basically saying your protagonist is young. Or at least that's what I kind of get. But anyway.
It's both saying that your protagonist is young, and it is saying that you have a certain level more of flexibility in terms of cosmology and setup, especially as a first-time author. I'm seeing a lot more genre bending and genre breaking in YA right now.
Yeah.
Because you are writing for an audience that has not yet become so wedded to a structure that they won't bend off of it.
Right.
And so inured to cliche that they'll be like, oh God, it's another gotta save the girl. You know, you have a much more accepting audience in YA. They are more willing to let you take risks and experiment, and they are more willing to accept plot elements that might be viewed as overworked and cliche in adult work. I am not calling your plot cliche. I am saying that if you go to a lot of adult publishers right now and say, okay, so this boy has to save his sister who's been kidnapped, and they'll be like, yeah, we're done right there.
Right.
Peace out. And they have fire and ice powers. Really? Do you like the X-Men?
Yes, I do.
I love the X-Men, but you know.
Who doesn't?
Yeah.
Well, and the aspect that stood out to me was that she's discovering her own abilities, and that's very, very YA to me.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, well, it's almost a coming of age.
Well, and let's put that on the shelf. I mean, Sean, I think Sean's observations are accurate, and I can see the same thing. And Gloria, take that, you know, in the spirit of this might be complete bullshit, but worthy of consideration.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm seeing very, very prominently is that you've got a lot of every one of these characters is a protagonist. I mean, you've got a pilot who's the daughter of the greatest thief in the world. You've got a guy who is a blind thief. Anyone, you know, the grifter, the gladiator who escaped from the unescapable prison. I mean, all of these people are drawn with such broad strokes and epic, epic backgrounds that each of them. I think part of the problem that you might be having is that they're all trying to command the spotlight because you've drawn them that way.
Yeah.
And
kind of do.
You know, I'm not going to advocate a massive rewrite, but another possibility, something to consider, is to either tone them down, at least maybe some of the ragtag group, or consider, you know, evolving their storyline separately and weaving them in discreetly as instigators and motivators of the main story arc, which is, you know, Niamh and Noelle.
Mm-hmm.
The other possibility is maybe this isn't their story. Maybe this is Thea's story. Maybe, like Seanan said at the beginning, it's an ensemble piece with these epic heroes of Thea, Elliot, Leo, and Kai. It's their story, and Niamh and Noelle are coming in bringing their next adventure as they start off on their next ribald wildness of mayhem and whatever else they might indulge in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I what do you, does that sit at all with you?
Actually, it does. And it's some stuff that, this is a piece that, I've been working on for, like I've known these characters for probably 6 or 7 years at this point. And it's taken on so many different forms, and it's actually just, it's just come into this current world setting form that it has that I have thought about. My original wanting for this was for it to be an ensemble piece, and I kind of have just been molding it around like clay, trying to figure out a way to make it something else or make it something different or figure out different things with it. The Noelle and Niamh was just, that story was the one that I jumped on because it was a way to actually get this ensemble together, if that makes sense.
Okay.
So you're really focusing on the leverage angle then. You're looking for your start for your... I love Leverage. It is one of my favorite shows currently on television. I'm actually going to go watch them filming next month, so I'm really excited about that.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah, like seriously. But... Leverage as a structure works because it is visual, which is not don't do this as a written work, but what you may want to do, and this is something that worked really well for me, but it also, again, complete bullshit, blah, blah, blah. You may want to stop and write something else. Because if you want to do the ensemble, if for you that is where the heart of this story lies, is being able to do it as an ensemble piece, you may just need to do some more heavy lifting so that you get to where you can figure out how that would work.
That's actually kind of a cool suggestion.
Yeah.
Instead of jumping in on this thing that has consumed you, that clearly has a great deal of weight and substance in your heart, to pursue some shorter fiction around the periphery, maybe some one-offs with Elliot or Leo, some of their backstory stuff that will allow you to expose your readers to your cosmology and your world, and also one character. And then, God, that would be awesome. Then you gather them together. It's like what Marvel did with the Avengers.
Right.
Then you bring them together.
Or go write a novel in a completely different setting.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, grow as a writer to give yourself the lifting power you need to say, no, all y'all, fuck y'all. This is my ensemble story, and there is nothing like it, and it is going to work. I have no protagonist because I have 8 protagonists. But you need to establish a very strong voice for yourself before you're going to be able to pull that off.
Okay.
And that may well mean saying, yeah, I went on a story roundtable. What'd they tell you? They told me to stop writing my book.
I am okay with that. I actually have I'm one of those people that when I graduated from college, I like to continue to keep doing multiple things at the same time. I have no problem with you guys saying, hey, you might want to just let that percolate for a little bit longer.
Well, not just let that percolate, work and lift. Rosemary and Rue was my first book. I wrote it in high school. And
really?
It was terrible. Oh my God. It was fuck awful. I rewrote it 10 times in the process of learning how to lift. And it was not until I stepped out of that world, I wrote Feed, and got stronger because I was lifting different things, that I was able to come back to Rosemary and Rue and say, okay, this is where the problem is, and rewrite it and make it publishable.
Excellent.
It took stepping out of one world and into another to get the lifting where it needed to be. So I'm not saying make this your trunk novel, but I'm also not necessarily saying play with these characters more, because your problem isn't that your characters are weak. Your problem is that your characters are all stronger than you can carry right now.
Okay.
So go to different characters that you care about less.
That's excellent advice.
And learn to care about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's fabulous. I certainly wouldn't have thought to suggest that. So thank you, Sean, and holy crap. That's why we bring seasoned authors onto this show, Brian.
That's right.
What are you seasoning me with?
definitely some cayenne pepper. I can see that. And perhaps a bit of cumin, just because I like saying it. So
it is a fun word. It's a good word to say.
It is. Absolutely.
And a really tasty spice.
Yes. We love that.
Cumin.
Brian?
Yeah.
I'm not sure where to go from here. Help me out, man.
I'm going to, because I like to get my hands bloody a little bit.
Please.
I'm going to go locally into the story, and you know, I say absolutely 100% take everything that Seanan just said, and now I'm going to flip it, and I'm going to jump back into the local aspect. And there's two things that for me I want to see, and one is some inciting event near the beginning where, like you're saying, you know, freedom fighters / terrorists, and you're leaning more toward the terrorist. And I want to see that. I want to see something happen at the beginning that goes wrong, that they didn't intend necessarily to go the way that it did, where they missed the target and killed a bunch of children, or, you know, something horrific. And then that's going to create for the whole rest of the story a rift within the Misfits, where you have some who look at it as, hey, that's collateral damage. You know, we're at war. And it's a necessity. It's something that's going to happen. And maybe now they'll sit up and pay attention to us. And then others within the group who are like, fuck that. That's, you know, it's completely not okay. And then you have a little bit of a rift between Noel and Neum. And maybe Neum, because he's fire, was, you know, the cause of it and was going off of bad information. And so there, then you have something that's sort of driving everybody and causing a lot more conflict within the group itself. And I think that's almost a necessity. The other thing that I really want to see is I love the concept of the character of the voice. I want, as a reader, to, through the entire thing, question his intentions and really at some times think that he is an asshole and somebody who is really driving them in the wrong direction. But then if you want him to be just really knowing everything and working for good and helping them out, I don't think that we should think that he is through most of the book. I think it should be something that we constantly question.
He might be the best thing to come along, or he might be the worst thing that came along in their lives.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And even though, like, he may suggest something to them that causes them to go do things that to them are you know, backbreaking and mind-bending and where they're questioning, going, this guy is crazy and, you know, he's going to cause our downfall. But in the end, he's absolutely right. Well, every step of the way. And we don't see that until the end.
Well, what if, and classic what if,
right.
Taking a page from Shannon's book, specifically her first book, Shannon, when I started reading Rosemary and Rue, I was like, the prologue, you had me at the prologue. What a fabulous hook to see a character as they are. Everything's great. They got family. That's all good. Yada, yada. She's got the skills to make this all happen. And then, bam, she's a fish for 14 years or 16 years, how long that was. And picking up the main thrust of the story after that. And Gloria, what if this scene where Thea, Niamh, and Noelle steal the relic is in your prologue? And the voice has guided them to steal this relic. And this relic has got to have a much larger significance of some kind other than just in the freedom fighting zone. And the voice actually somehow has betrayed them, has led them to get bad information, and allows everything to go completely sideways. And the team has to literally mow a path of mayhem and destruction. Everybody's hurt, wounded. Maybe they take a critical wound and Liam has a permanent limp now, or Noelle is horribly disfigured or something along those lines. And then pick it up years later when the echoes of that event that everybody's just trying to forget comes back and the voice resurges for the first time in years to try and draw this group back together again to accomplish something. I don't know what. But that as a kickoff point allows you to give us that very nice, this is how cool these guys are, and oh crap, now things aren't cool anymore. And that might actually nudge you out of that YA's vibe a little bit too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And remember, if you don't feel like maiming someone you actually like, if that's your prologue, nobody knows which of these characters you're planning to keep.
Mm-hmm.
So right, set up your Jesse from Buffy. Set up your guy who's, you know, been with them the whole time. He's the best friend. He's the lover. He's the one that has all of the computer security codes, whatever. He's the one whose head just became an interesting splatter pattern on the back wall. You know, we don't know when we pick it up which of these is actually a main character that we're keeping.
Right. Right.
Awesome.
Well,
so you can slaughter people. I do want to take a moment while I have stolen the microphone, though, to make a couple quick comments. One, never say based on again.
Okay.
He was inspired by. It is an homage to. I encountered this character type, and I wanted to do something. If I actually see this book on a shelf and I pick it up, I do not want to read it and go, oh, it's that dude from Dark Angel.
Right.
Because that's what gets you in trouble. And based on is what gets you in trouble. Everybody has character type homages. Everybody's written, you know, I encountered, Verity Price in my encrypted books was entirely inspired by a contestant on So You Think You Can Dance. Awesome. But she was inspired by, she was not based on, because one of those is okay. And one of those gets you into potentially sticky, icky territory if this becomes a huge bestseller and then there's a movie and then suddenly you're being sued by J.J. Abrams. And that's not a fun party. Also, never say ragtag batch of misfits again. Gotcha. I will find your house. There will be like a polite knock and you'll open the door and there'll be a blonde chick in a pink shirt with bows in her hair. I'll be like, hi, Gloria. I have a machete. And you'll go, oh, God.
Or a chainsaw.
Or a chainsaw. Or a rattlesnake. I have one of those too. Because ragtag batch of misfits is, it's a warning word.
Oh, I know. That phrase.
It's a cliche.
For me to just use the cliche to describe what I was going. That actually is never going to be used as.
The problem is that if you use it to describe, it becomes a crutch to describe. And then you're trying to pitch it to an agent or trying to explain it to someone that you want to read it for a pre-pub blurb. And it comes out of your mouth and you have just lost them completely.
That's good advice.
And that doesn't sound like a writing note, but it actually is, because how you describe it influences how you think about it. And you don't want to think about them as a batch of misfits. You want to think about them as a group of people, every single one of whom is perfect. Just ask them.
Awesome.
I love that.
That's excellent advice.
Yes.
Awesome. Guys, I'm watching the clock tick down, so I'd like to move us into final words. Seanan, final suggest, advice, guidance to Gloria as she moves forward in both in her career and with this story?
You know, you have to read. I'm assuming you read a lot. Read more.
Mm-hmm.
I think, honestly, do need to read some YA. Like, sit down and give it a go. Not because this story necessarily is YA, but because people are going to ask you why it's not.
Mm-hmm.
Can you recommend some?
With your setting, it sounds like you've encountered some bad YA, or some YA that is not necessarily to your liking, and that is going to keep you avoiding the entire area. Take a look at the Divergent series by Veronica Roth. That's R-O-T-H. She's doing one of the post-apocalyptic societal totally rebuilt things. Take a look at Partials by Dan Wells. He's the guy that wrote I Am Not a Serial Killer, which is a fantastic book in and of itself. I've been packing my books, so there aren't nearly as many around here to look at right now. But The Unidentified by Ray Mariz is absolutely fantastic. So is Lost Voices by Sarah Porter. These are all very different types of YA. Lost Voices has no romance in it at all, which is actually pretty rare in the YA world. But it doesn't matter, because the strength of the story is what winds up carrying it. Anything by Scott Westerfeld. You start with Uglies, read Uglies, Pretties, Specials, his Parasite Positive series, the Midnighters books. There are people that are doing really inventive and exciting things with YA, and I think if you read some of those, you'll see what I meant about your setting having more of a young adult feel to it.
Okay.
You should probably also take a look at Girl Genius by Phil and Kaya Folio.
Ah, yes.
If you haven't read that already, it's an online comic series. You can read the entire thing for free. They've also been novelizing the comics because, oddly, the single strongest X is like Y feeling I get off of your setting is that your setting is very much like their Spark-centric Europe.
Okay.
Which is not, oh, this is a steampunk setting, just that you are closer to their territory than you are to anything else I've seen.
Oh, I know that. The steampunk science is as far sciency as I'm going.
Good.
So.
But the big thing to keep in mind is I hereby, by the power vested in me by this big fluffy blue cat, grant you the permission to suck.
Thank you.
You are gonna need to suck. You are doing something really ambitious, regardless of whether you take any of our suggestions or none of our suggestions. Just your setting alone is a very ambitious thing. And if you look at your page and go, oh my God, this sucks, I have to start over, you're never going to hit the end.
Mm-hmm.
So you get to suck for at least 4 drafts before I expect you to produce something that can be read by humans.
It's excellent.
And then the one thing we didn't actually get to, but that I'd like you to consider for when you're looking at restructuring your story and doing your rewrites, is I think you'll get a lot of flack for starting with a brother and sister team and having the sister be the one that immediately gets captured and spends the entire story in a relatively passive or confined position.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can twist things around to capture the brother, that would be something we haven't seen before or haven't seen nearly as much.
Very cool. Yeah.
Which is not do it, but, you know, either make her more active or capture him.
Yeah. Especially since he has almost the what we would view as the more potent power of fire, and that ice does seem to be more passive in and of itself, to then have her have to use a more what would seem to be a more passive power and have it end up being much more volatile than the fire one.
Sure. Brian, final thoughts, closing thoughts?
It's difficult to riff on any more than that. I think I want you to play. I want you to jump into this and just play around. And you know, kind of going along what a lot of Shannon was saying, you don't have to sit down and write this right away, you know, go into other things. But I think it's also fun just to play within this world and with some of the characters, because then you can pull things from those little pieces and without having to explain the entire extra, you know, extemporaneous piece that you have, you can pull in aspects of it that the reader will fill in the blanks, and it'll just make everything that much richer. But I think you have an excellent start here and an outline, and I think if you play around, you're going to find some really fascinating stuff to work into your story. So I'm excited to see what you do with it.
Absolutely. And I will echo all of that. A fabulous setting, strong, powerful characters. And you really, you one gauges one's heroism by the challenges one chooses, and yes, by that standard, you are a fucking hero, Gloria. Holy crap. This is beyond epic, and I applaud you for not only diving into this for 6 years, but having the courage to put it out. Thank you for that and giving us a chance to riff on it. My one suggestion for the whole Niamh and Noelle thing is, after Noelle gets captured, she escapes and starts kicking ass, but she's trapped in the compound and finding out more and more about this larger story that's being told. So her story is much more active and exciting, but it's separate from Niamh, and we know she's going to die. Right now she's running and fighting as best she can, and then have Niamh and Thea and crew closing in. Will they make it in time? God, she's so kick-ass, but she's about to go up against something she cannot win. And of course, the voice underneath all of it, the dark, shadowy presence that is either friend or foe, and no one knows for sure. I just, sweetness. I love it. It's fabulous.
Dave, you're so cute when you get inspired.
Oh, God, I can't help myself, because this is inspiring. This is great stuff.
It is. It's fabulous.
I'm just going to picture you doing that creepy voice anytime you want anyone to do anything forever. And it's time to come to dinner, little girl. Okay.
Hello, you're the pizza man. Excellent. Come in. Yes.
You don't get pizza delivered very often, do you? No. They're like, fuck, I'm not going there.
I'll leave the pizza here in the driveway. See ya. Yeah. So, God, awesomeness. Thank you, Gloria, so much for the bravery to step up and for offering up such a fabulous story. We deeply appreciate that. Shannon. Oh, no, wait. And before we sign off from Gloria, we always exact a vow that when you actually do write this epic thing, and you soar among the eagles and beyond on the glory of this epic multi-part series that continues to enhance the world in multitudinous ways, that you return to us and please let us know so we can put your name on our soon-to-be glorious Hall of Fame, and we can sing your praises that you came on to us first.
I have a really convenient name for the singing of praises.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, please stop.
Angelic choir, all of that. Do you swear this, Gloria?
I do.
Excellent.
As long as you never sing my name again.
If we do, it'll be with bass kettle drums and French horns. Gloria. There we go. Shannon, holy crap, you have brought so much gold to this conversation, taking it to places that honestly we've never been before, and I cannot express to you the gratitude and appreciation for being willing to come on and for taking us into those places, because those are places writers need to go, and thank you for making the time.
No problem.
Because this is what I do.
Awesome. Sleep is for the week.
Yeah. Brian, any final words before we bring this puppy down?
No, I did want to say to Shannon that you definitely brought up some stuff that as writers we're afraid to face.
Yes.
And so I thank you for that, because, you know, for me, I feel like it's hard for me to like push somebody in a direction that they don't want to go. I want to coddle and like hold them and, you know, but I think that the things that you said are things that need to be considered. They need to be said. And so thank you for coming on and having the courage to say those things that the rest of us avoid.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, will you not kill the puppy now?
No, we won't kill. We won't put it down. We'll put it to bed. We'll put it to
okay.
bed.
Okay.
So, you know, and I would expect nothing less from someone who's been bit by a king cobra. So that's just
right.
Too badass. So, friends, thank you, as always, for hitting the play button and tuning in. Whenever you're tuning in, you are, of course, the reason why we keep doing this. Thank you for your comments. We so appreciate it. Keep them coming. Still working to build up enough content for an actual feedback show, so send us a line at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. We would love to have material questions. Anything that you care to throw into the pot, we'll mix it up with cumin and cayenne pepper and any other spice that we care to throw in. iTunes is always a good place to throw out a review. Also, the website, we're going to have all the awesomeness that Shannon and Gloria mentioned through this up in links and mentions and comments in the liner notes. Stay tuned next week, because this starts all over again. More authors, more workshops, more story ideas. The Gloriosity just keeps unfolding like a great unfolding thing. Yes. That's exactly where I was going with that, because I got nothing.
Brian, I could hear you lose that thread.
Fade away. Brian, any closing observations, suggestions, yes. or impulses?
Oh, just to our listeners, you now have my permission to shut off your iPod or other listening device and go write.
Go write. And to my addition to that is, friends, you find what you're looking for. So go look for awesome things. Look for wow. You will find it. Until then, you guys continue to astonish and amaze. Thank you so much, and we will talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Definitely. Bye-bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com. Or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is @writerspodcast. Or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.